The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So today I'd like to start a series of talks on mindful speech, the practice of speech, bringing practice to speech. And I use that expression carefully, mindful speech, to include something broader than ethical speech. There's a lot of discussion in Buddhism on right speech, what kind of speech is ethical, and things like that. But that's in some ways the icing on the cake. It's very important how we speak and what we say. But when we think about Buddhist spirituality or spiritual practice, how we speak is an important part of that. But it's often useful to see how it fits into a larger context. And not just a context, but fits into something more deeper in ourselves than what comes out of our mouths. Now, it can be quite consequential what we say. It's often pointed out that the primary way that people are connected to each other is through speech, through our friends, our neighbors, our work, through all kinds of situations. It's how we speak that we make our connections. And it doesn't take a lot of reflection to realize how much suffering can come from speech, and also how much healing and joy and delight can come from how we speak as well. It stands out and highlights for me the discussion in the public arena these days, in the news. So much of it has to do with speech, with the election and what the presidential candidates are saying and what other people are saying. And it's very consequential what people say. Elections are lost and won on what people say. And also the impact that our speech has. I'm struck also by the state of our current economy and how a number of people are saying that our economy is built a lot on confidence, not so much on finances. And so having a president or presidential candidates say things that express confidence in the system translates into a whole nation or a whole globe of people, hopefully, who get the message and then change their habits, they change their action. And if there's a loss of confidence through what people say, that has a detrimental impact as well. So these things play out also in our daily lives. What we say can have a big impact on the morale, the confidence. It can have a big impact on how divisive our relationships are, or how healing or connected they are. They also have a big impact on how well we're connected to ourselves and how we feel about ourselves. I've said things that I've later regretted, not just regretted for the moment, but regretted to this day. I regret some things I've said. It has lingering effect. And things that people have said to me has had lingering effect on me. And what comes to mind right now is when I was about 13 or 14, and I suppose I was just getting interested in girls. And so I came home to dinner one day and said something about some girl that I had some contact with. The first time I ever said something like that at home to my parents. And what I got in return was being teased. And it was kind of, I think I'm sure it was good-hearted, you know, good-natured, whatever. But in my fragile 13-year-old ego, it was really difficult. And so as a result, I never talked to my parents about my relationships with girls throughout my teenage years. Just not going there again. And so, you know, some small little thing that maybe was innocent enough in their eyes had a big influence over me in a long time. In talking about speech, in trying to broaden it into kind of mindfulness of speech, it might be useful to distinguish between morality and ethics. Morality, one way of defining morality is that it's a code of conduct, kind of the rules and codes by which people live their lives by. And ethics is the theory behind those codes, behind those rules, It's the principles, the ideas, the values that are behind it. And if we go to rush into the code of conduct, you know, you should always speak truthfully, you should always speak kindly, you should always speak what's beneficial, a variety of things. If you rush into the conduct without understanding the values and principles behind it, then I think it's kind of can be kind of shallow and also a little bit fragile in the whole thing. If we understand something about the values behind it, it isn't just a matter of the understanding the values in Buddhism, but also understanding the body, the physical body or the heart that from which those values come out of. And so it's a matter of touching into something deeper in us than some intellectual understanding. So I'll give you, I think it's a wonderful example. Some years ago, there was a doctoral study done at Saybrook, a university or college here in San Francisco. And it studied the ethical IQ of high school graduates. And it gave them, I guess, kind of a test, ethical test, to see how ethical they were, and of different high schools around the country. And one of the results that was very consistent was high school graduates from the Waldorf school system. It's a particular kind of private school kind of system, particular pedagogy. They scored exceptionally high in ethical IQs, comparable, accordingly, to graduate students in philosophy. So, you know, I don't know what makes them so ethical, but at least primarily they've been wrestling with these issues in a way. And but there was one exception, and the exception was a high school in Honolulu. So the advisor to the doctoral student said, "You have to go to Honolulu and find out why that's the exception." And so the researcher went there and looked into it, and found out that indeed it was apparently a public high school, I think, or it wasn't, at least it was not a Waldorf high school. But it turned out a good percentage of those high school students had gone to a Waldorf grade school earlier, you know. So then, the question is, so then the theory, the question was, well, if it had something to do with the Waldorf system, and something happened before, like, sixth grade, what was it about the first 6 years of the Waldorf education that led these kids to later be so, you know, have much higher ethical capacity than other people? So no one knows for sure. But the Waldorf system's theory about why this is the case is because in the early grades, the Waldorf system teaches mindfulness of the body. Isn't that something? As opposed to saying, well, thou shalt not. but rather developed a heightened sensitivity, awareness of their own body and their own body in relationship to other people. And they do it a variety of different ways. My son goes to Waldorf school, and some of it seems a little bit odd to me to say it. It's a wise speech day. It may be, they do a kind of dance that a lot of the kids kind of don't like so much. But it puts them in their bodies, and it puts and they dance together in a very coordinated way, and they have to be tuned into each other. From starting in first grade, tune into each other as a group, doing these different moves and dances and kind of things, Tai Chi kind of things. And I think it's one of the ways they're teaching, you know, to be present in your body, be aware of your body. They teach math partly through the body. They actually have the kids standing in the classroom and moving as they do the multiplication tables to get them in their body. So the idea of being in your body, I'm not here to champion Waldorf. I'm here to champion the importance of being in our body. And how is it being connected and being sensitive through our body leads to becoming more ethical? I think a simple answer is that there's much more sensitivity to the world around us and to how the world affects us and to what's going on inside ourselves when we're connected to our body. And our body will reveal a lot to us about the impact of our speech, the impact of the source of the motivation for our speech, and the relationship our speech has to how we feel in here. If we speak in unkind ways and harsh ways, and you're connected to your body while you speak that way, you'll feel how lousy it feels in your own body. If you speak in kind ways and you're connected to your body, you'll feel how that feels like in your own body. If you're connected to your body and you're with someone who's suffering, chances are you have greater capacity for empathy, because picking up other people's emotions is not just a cognitive thing. You know, you sit there and you look at them and say, oh, their mouth is turned down and there's drops of water coming out of the ear, their other eyes, and this must mean that, you know, it's not like that. It's you kind of pick it up, you know, viscerally. And so the more we're connected here, the more we can pick up and be aware of. Also, mindfulness of the body only occurs in the present moment. You're connected to the present moment if you're in your body. So the greater the attentiveness is through your body, the more you're tuning into what's happening here and now. The more we're tuning into things through our thinking, more likely it is that we fall into the past, we fall into the future, we fall into all kinds of things. I've had conversations with people occasionally, almost. I've had I'm having a nice conversation, and then something they say makes me think about something. I start thinking about it, and they keep talking, and I'm thinking about it. What did they say? Can you please repeat that? Where were you? You know, I can lose touch completely. Now, none of you, I'm sure, has that problem. And and sometimes it's even more embarrassing. The thing I'm thinking about is what I know they need to be told. And there, a couple of times I've wondered, you know, I think I need to tell them something, but I wonder, did they just tell that to me? It's a little bit dangerous to say something to people if, you know, you're not paying attention to what they're saying. So anyway, the body is much more in the present moment. When we look at the place where right speech occurs in the Eightfold Path being the classic description of the path of practice, right speech happens after orienting oneself on the path, having a sense of where the path is, and after establishing the right attitude for being on the path. So after those two things are established, and then we actually start walking the path, according to the Eightfold Path, the first step is right speech. The first actually, you know, walking the path, living it, practicing it, is offered through right speech. I think it's a great thing because it's the foundation for so much that follows. And it's establishing a foundation for our path of practice in our relationship to other people and our relationship to ourselves, in a relationship. It's very easy to practice meditation. Many people get interested in Buddhism first because of meditation. And they don't realize that that's actually the advanced step of the path. You're supposed to kind of prepare yourself. And the first way you prepare yourself is establishing good relationships. You don't wait until you get them perfect. But, somewhat good relationships with the world around you, people around you. And so focusing on your speech is one way. But it comes after getting oriented and having the right attitude. So there's preparation involved. And one of the best preparations happens to be meditation. So it's all circular. And so we don't get too strict about this, have follow these step-like way. So if you do something like mindfulness meditation, or any kind of meditation, and develop a deeper connection to yourself, deeper capacity for calm, a deeper capacity to pause, and a deeper capacity to listen, then you have a greater sensitivity, empathy, to suffering in yourself and suffering outside. you have greater understanding, sensitivity to happiness and peace within, and happiness and peace in others as well. And that greater sensitivity then gives you a very important information about how we want to relate to people, how we want to relate to ourselves. So we start with developing this greater sensitivity. And what's beautiful about cultivating mindfulness is it's not just a matter of creating greater sensitivity, but chances are fairly high as you become more sensitive, more present, more mindful, you start feeling better. Calm, mindful presence over time produces a much better internal sense of well-being. If we're always busy, running around, thinking, anxious about this and that, projecting forward and backward in time with our thoughts, it's hard for us to settle into our bodies and into our hearts. If we're present and learn how to let go of our thoughts, we have a chance of settling, relaxing, unwinding, and hopefully discovering some deeper sense of well-being. That deeper sense of well-being, in turn, provides a wonderful foundation to look at how do we want to relate to other people. I think most of you understand or have seen that how you speak to others, and perhaps also to yourself, has a lot to do with the state of your mood, your mental state, how you are. If you are really angry and upset and late and frustrated, the chances of saying something really fast that you'll regret for years is a lot easier to say than if you're relaxed and quiet and happy. I've seen it in myself, frustration, where I just... And the place I've seen it in the last years that has been the most challenge, actually, is in family life with kids. And there's a way in which they kind of lead me to become, to be frustrated. And it's so hard because, you know, it's hard to know when you're supposed to do things and say things, and so then err on the side of waiting too long or something. And then there's been a couple of times where one of my sons had said something or done something, and the words came out of my mouth before I chose to have them come out. Boom. Where'd that come from? How could that be? But the condition for that was, it didn't just come out of the blue. I was in a particular mood. I was in a particular state of being, frustrated, upset, hurried, impatient. And so that led to kind of, the conditions for speaking quite quickly. Then there have been other times where I've been very calm, feel good, centered. And I've walked into a situation which, and other times, would be very, very frustrating. And, I can take it. all kinds of things, yelling and screaming. Sometimes I go home and they call it the witching hour. Some of you have had kids know this expression. I didn't know about it until I had kids. The witching hour, it's usually around 5 o'clock before dinner. Boy. And I've had situations at home where I've tried every possible parenting trick, every possible one I could think of, to try to get decent behavior from a kid. That decent behavior meaning alternative to angry, frustrating, demanding, yelling, snarling, just... And nothing helped. Nothing. Until we coaxed him into eating. And, we coaxed him into, tricked him into eating some food. Finally, he settled down. It was a food issue. It wasn't an ethical issue or, it wasn't a parenting issue. And so I tell you that story just that, that how frustrating it can be when nothing works. And so there have been times when I've gone back, come home, and I've been in a very spacious, calm kind of, I feel good, and nothing the kid will say will faze me. And there's nothing comes out of my mouth spontaneously. So that our mood, the way we feel, has a big impact on how we are and what we say. So before looking at the ethics or the, you know, or morality of speech, I think it's much more important to look at how we can become mindful, attentive, more sensitive to ourselves, and develop and move ourselves to a greater sense of well-being. So meditation hopefully is one of that, one of those ways. Another way that we have in Buddhism is cultivating loving kindness. Learning about the practice of loving kindness or friendliness, and then not just leaving it to chance, but actually spending some time cultivating some friendliness, some kindness. So then we come into situations, we're more predisposed to tune into the situation from a kind perspective. Sometimes before I go into new situations, with social situations, I'll spend some time sitting in the car, doing something before I go in, reflecting on loving kindness, thinking about it, practicing loving kindness a little bit. And I don't tend to bring the practice with me into the social situations normally, but I'll kind of try to predispose myself. It's not a matter of talking myself into something I'm not. It's mostly a matter of reminding myself. It's really great, friendliness. It's such a nice thing. So there are these practices. So thinking about practices. And then while we speak, while we're in conversation, there are things to do in conversations that come prior to reflecting on what we should say in the situation. And one of the great things to do is to be mindful of what's happening in the conversation. I try to spend a lot of time being mindful of my body when I'm in conversation. What's happening to me here? Because I get all these cues about my state of mind, my reactions, my motivations from my own body. So is my stomach getting tense? Am I starting to kind of tighten up in some way? Am I starting to get tired? Getting tired is a wonderful cue in conversation. You know, getting bored, it's a wonderful cue. If you knew how wonderful it was, you would stop getting bored right away. It's often an indication that something interesting is happening right now. And to look more carefully, what's happening? What's going on here? So one of the ways of being mindful in conversation is to be more interested in listening than in talking. I love the expression, God gave us two ears and one mouth so we can listen twice as much as we speak. I get to speak so much as a Dharma teacher because I did all my listening before. I do find it very strange to be sitting in front of all these people just talking away. It seems very odd to me, but anyway, yeah, you guys seem to be listening. Keep coming back, some of you. So I felt a little bit self-conscious, of course, saying that, you know, listen twice as much as you speak, and then I'm monopolizing the conversation. So listening is a great thing. And what we listen to is not only the other person, but also to ourselves. Now, one of the great things to listen to and to explore in mindfulness of speech is listen to your own self-talk. How do you talk to yourself? And when we get to the ethical aspects, so the moral kind of things around speaking in a few weeks, how would you evaluate the ethics of your own self-talk? Chances are there are people who would never say out loud the things that they say to themselves about other people, but even more amazing, about themselves. Sometimes people are more cruel to themselves in their self-talk than they are to other people. So to listen to that as well. What are we saying? What are we thinking? What are we telling ourselves in different situations? And then, before looking at the morality of it, become sensitive to how that self-talk is affecting our body, heart, and mind. It's not just disembodied words. If it's very harsh and critical, it hurts. And to feel the pain of that is actually a very important information. And one of the things we do in mindfulness practice is we stop for hurt. We stop for suffering. The Buddhist bumper sticker. I stop for suffering. And it's an important bumper sticker because most people's bumper sticker is I avoid suffering. I run from suffering. I blame for suffering. anything but be present for it. And there are people who get angry when they get to hear that you're supposed to stop and pay attention to suffering. But in the Buddhist context, Buddhist spirituality, there's a tremendous amount of learning that can happen when we stop and pay attention to suffering. We can learn what the causes of it, what triggers it, what the impulses are behind it, what the beliefs are. And also by stopping and feeling, sensing where the hurt is, there's a half a chance for that hurt place inside of us to relax, that hurt place inside of us to soften. But if we don't give it a fair chance don't give presence to that place of hurt, it doesn't have a chance to teach us and doesn't have a chance to soften. And so if we recoil from the hurt, chances are that the mind, the thinking mind, will perpetuate the kind of patterns of thinking that only causes more pain, puts more salt in the wound. So the idea of listening and paying attention, stopping and noticing what's here. There are people who teach the practice of mindful speaking. A number of Buddhist teachers who really specialize in it. And one of the first things they always say around what to do in mindful speaking is to pause. So what does pausing have to do with it? Pausing gives you a chance to relax. Pausing gives you a chance to tune in to what's going on. Pausing gives you a chance to reflect more deeply. What is it you actually want to say? So to pause. Pause long enough that we can reflect, consider what is actually happening in this whole event of communication. What is being communicated? What are we speaking from? What's the container out of which the speaking is coming from? So what's the container here? Who are you? What container have you made for yourself? Container meaning what kind of body, mind, heart, kind of mood or state have you created here? What kind of body, state, mind do you want to have when you speak? Can you take some responsibility for the container from which you speak? So pause. Tune into that. And one of the great little statements in conversation is, let me think about that a little bit. just a moment. Let me kind of be with that a little bit. Most people will give you a few seconds then, if you say it that way. And then you check in and tune in and feel. And the more charged the conversation is, the more useful it is to say, let me think about that for a moment. And even a more effective practice this way in really charged conversations is to say, we'll continue this in a moment, but I really need to go to the bathroom. You don't necessarily say why you need to go to the bathroom. I need to go to the bathroom so I can breathe. But you just went to the bathroom. Well, you know, when it's coming, you know, it's coming. So any kind of tricks of the trade to pause, to slow down the conversation, can be very helpful. So what are some of the areas in your body that are useful to notice when you're about to speak or when you're in conversation? So it's in your life and what you've noticed. Would any of you like to share some of your body parts? What parts of your body do you find particularly informative to pay attention to? Yes, please.
Certainly my voice tends to tighten up and get a little bit higher. And I can feel a tightening in my chest, for sure, if it's a highly charged a situation.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you.
I notice sometimes when I'm speaking that my arms have crossed and they're kind of tense. And to me, that's a reminder that I need to be more mindful about what's needed mm-hmm. in the conversation from Great. My part.
Great. So crossing your arms. And it communicates so much. Cross your arms and tuck your chin down. And are you really listening then? So thank you.
I notice sometimes a lot of sensation in my solar plexus, and that seems to be when I'm in touch with that area, when it feels sort of alive, is when there's more authenticity in what I say.
So when you're aware there, it's more alive, more sensations there, then you feel more authentic?
Yeah, and like it's coming from it just feels more aligned with what I sort of truly mean. Mm-hmm. In a way, then I'm not warping my speech when I'm in touch with that area.
And what happens to your solar plexus when you're not being authentic?
Either it's numb or there's more of a constricted, like a more constricted feeling.
Okay, thank you.
One of the things that is important for me is noticing where my eyes are, whether I'm looking at the person, whether I'm looking down, whether I'm looking in a corner, and also whether my... since I have a tendency to frown, whether I'm tightening up my brow muscles.
Thank you.
My example is before I start speaking, if I'm just thinking bad thoughts, I get really tight in my neck and my shoulders. Mm. And then I just try to breathe and calm down before I speak.
That's great. Thank you. Neck and shoulders. Behind you?
If I'm in a highly charged situation, my stomach just goes... And then my jaw will tighten.
Thank you.
I know we don't teach Kundalini here, but when I can really notice what's happening in one of those highly charged or emotional situations, I feel like I can notice energy coming from my stomach and then to my heart and then shooting up into my head. And there's some kind of energetic pressure in my head that just makes me want to send that energy outward to the world, perhaps in the form of hasty speech.
In form of what?
In the form of
hasty
speech.
Great, thank you. So energy changes here in the front. Yeah. Jeannie.
If I am receiving communication from somebody and I have feelings, my body starts tensing up or... I'm feeling something coming from them, and I check my intentions, and I know my intentions are neutral. I then wonder what their intention is, and very often their intention is to do something to get me to react some way, or to maybe to cause angry or some kind of other reaction, especially with children. And so then when I know that, though, when I know what they're doing, it helps me to step back and take a different perspective rather than just react. But it does take that stepping back, kind of not saying anything immediately until I kind of figure out what's really going on.
And so one of the reference points for you is your own intention. And if your own intention is, you said, neutral, then you're easier for you to see what's coming from the other person.
Exactly, yeah.
Great. Thank you. I saw hands in the back there.
I noticed that lots of times if I'm nervous or tense in a conversation that my hands are clenched, and that is like a signal for me to take a breath and relax.
Right here.
If I find myself leaning forward too much, I know I need to relax.
So leaning forward is an indication. I've noticed that when I give Dharma talks, if I'm getting nervous about whether I'm getting something across or not connected to the audience, sometimes I start leaning forward. Not always, though.
I have to pay attention to what I'm thinking. Because what I'm thinking, it's so fast, and then my body will, sometimes I don't even get a chance to even feel what my body's feeling because my thoughts come so fast. And actually an incident happened just a few days ago where somebody showed up at work and I didn't expect them and they didn't expect me. And I was thinking a thought that, why are they here when I'm here? And when are they supposed to be working? Why are they coming on the weekend? And the guy, when he came in, he said that exact same thing to me. And I thought, that is so cruel. Why talk to me like that? And I thought it, and I attracted it.
Thank you. Any other body parts?
One of the things that I've, learned in the last few years is not so much the body sensation, but realizing that many times when people are engaging me in conversation, I should really remain in a listening mode much longer instead of defaulting into, oh, they have a problem and I already know how to solve it. And so one of the most effective things that I found is simply to wait and listen and then see if they actually ask me for, do you have any suggestions? And in line with what you said, that tends to slow the conversation down and allow them to try to articulate it. And the only thing that I've noticed is sometimes I'm sort of feeling, okay, you know, kind of get on with it, but then I realize that there's struggling with how to express it, or there's this feeling that they're trying to get out, and I just have to be patient. So basically not going into a immediate problem-solving mode that interrupts their attempt to complete at their level mm-hmm. what they're trying to say.
Beautiful.
And I found that that's extremely helpful. A lot of times people actually aren't interested in what I would have to solve the problem, but then actually that really wasn't what they were after. They were just looking for someone to articulate what was inside them, and whether or not I could help or not, that wasn't really part of the equation for them.
It's beautiful. So in addition to the understanding, the wisdom you have about, you know, the importance of listening, what else, in addition to understanding, the understanding you expressed, what other things help you be a better listener?
Well, just realizing that if I'm listening to somebody and I'm thinking of ways to solve their problem, that I'm not really listening anymore. I'm off, and it may look to them like I'm listening, but my mind is actually in the problem-solving mode.
Great.
And so, as soon as I sense that happening, sometimes it's difficult because you may actually have a strong feeling like, oh, I know how to solve this problem, or like, it's obvious what to do, when in fact it may not be. So you have to sort of force yourself to drop out of that. So I guess that's the sort of key. But it's not really a feeling. It's more of a kind of like a daydreaming thing. You catch yourself solving their problem while they're talking. Mm-hmm. And you try to decouple those two events mm-hmm. in time so one comes after the other if they want it.
Great. So that requires mindfulness to be able to decouple. It's beautiful. So Cheryl.
Cry. I cry when I don't feel understood, or
when I feel like it's just not
going anyplace.
Uh-huh.
Or I don't know what to say. Might be that too.
Uh-huh.
But it's very common.
And it's hard too.
Because I don't think men are, they, you know.
I've heard time with men and women. But.
Great, thank you. So maybe one more. Laurie here.
I think for me, I really try to sense the space around my heart. So that if I am in a position where I may speak unwisely, contraction. And when I'm open, or I feel that openness around the heart, I know that I'm actually paying attention and being present, and I'm more likely to be kind and careful about what I'm saying.
Beautiful. So thank you, everyone. That was great, all those things people said, all of you said. So I'm sure we left out important body parts. The buttocks, some people tighten up there, the arms, the legs sometimes, the thighs, muscles along the spine sometimes can operate, all kinds of places. What I'd like to encourage you to do as we go through these next few weeks, we're going to explore speaking, the whole domain of speaking, is for this next week in particular, why don't you give more attention to the relationship between your speaking and being in conversation and what happens in your body. Maybe before you go into meet someone and have a conversation, maybe you tune into your body and feel what it's like when you're relaxed and whatever. And then notice what shifts in your body, what gets tense, what opens up. What happens in your body? What kind of information can you learn, can you get from your body that relates to the conversation you're having? So, and you might, what happens in your belly, your chest, your heart, your solar plexus, your neck, your shoulders, your jaws, your eyes, your forehead, your hands, your arms. There's a lot going on. And another one that's to pay attention to, related to all this, is your posture. Posture, maybe it's the whole body. What posture do you have when you're speaking? Hopefully you do this without any judgment. Just notice. I think this whole exploration of speech will be much, much richer for you, more useful for you, if you've grounded the whole exploration in your body. And maybe one day you'll score higher ethical IQ. Thank you so much.